Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Welcome into Tom, Jake, and Stacy, Thursday edition. This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy brought to you by Car Toys. Great to have our colleague Jake Heaps back in the house. Jake's got some bombshells to drop today.
I'm excited to be back. You know, I missed you guys.
Yeah,
looks like it's sunny where you are.
Yeah, it's nice and sunny down here in California. Ah. You know, I can't complain.
Oh, I didn't realize he was still down there. I thought he came back.
Look how nice it is there, and then look out our windows. It's kind of, well, I guess it's it's overcast. I know because I couldn't mow my lawn this morning.
Well, Stacy, all I see is neutral colored walls behind him. I don't see any sunshine. There's no more sunshine in his room than there is in mine.
You can tell it's bright. Outside. It's peeking out through the blinds. Let's get to the show.
No, I'd rather talk about
the weather. Rails.
That's fine.
All right.
Guys, I read a story last night. By the way, we got a big show planned for you today. Hope to get in touch with Brady Henderson. He told me something last night that was very revealing about the Antonio Brown sweepstakes. So I hope to get him on today. We'll try to do that at 1. Know Your Seahawk, Leno Hill edition at 2. And then Mike Salk will be coming on at 12:30. But when Jake returns and he's not been on the air for a couple of days, you know he's going to have something really important to say. Like, he's going to have some findings from wherever he's been. And it's good because it coincides with a tweet that I saw last night from super agent Lee Steinberg. He's actually the guy, for those of you who have not heard that name, he's the guy that Jerry Maguire was loosely based on back in the day. He's a really nice guy. We've had him on the air a bunch of times. Great agent. He said, in general, the worst way for a player to facilitate a trade is to go public with demands. Other teams know the player is unhappy and will lowball in trade offers, puts current team up against a wall. So take that for what it means. His perspective as an agent is that guys who publicly complain and publicly say they want out of a certain situation put both themselves and their teams at a disadvantage. We're talking about a couple of guys who do this, right? Jamal Adams of the Jets being the latest to do it. Actually, not the latest. The latest, the very latest, is Raheem Mostert of the 49ers, the running back who evidently talks are not going well with the 49ers. But before him, Jamal Adams, the safety from the Jets, he wants to trade bad. Jake, you got anything to say about that, bud?
Yeah, I got a few things to say about that. Well, I mean, first off, I think with Lee Steinberg, when you look at what he's talking about, it's true in the sense that it puts the team in a really bad position. And so now, instead of the trade happening right away, it's going to take longer and longer for that trade to come about because teams are going to lowball. And teams also know you're up against a deadline. Like, let's look at Yannick Ngakoue and Chris Jones, for example. Those are two guys that could be candidates for a potential Clowney situation where the team, a la the Houston Texans, they weren't able to get a deal done. Teams weren't really giving them offers they wanted. And then they had to get something done by the end of the season to just get something in return for that particular player, or they lose everything, right? They lose out on that talent. They lose out on that value. So I think that that's very true. Now, in the case of the Jets with Jamal Adams, it's very interesting because you guys know that I have said very clearly that I wouldn't really want Jamal Adams if Jamal Adams wanted a new contract right out of the gate, right? That was pretty much the thing that he said. But I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine who works in a front office on the other side of the country for an NFL team, and we were talking, and he actually said, "So your Seahawks are really into Jamal Adams?" And I was like, "Excuse? Like, what do you mean by that?" Right? Yeah, like,
what?
Oh, okay, I'm interested. I'm interested. And they're another team that's interested in Jamal Adams. And he said, yeah, the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing the Seahawks. Or the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing Jamal Adams in this situation. And, you know, the thing that is interesting about that and talking with this source is, you know, asking him about, okay, well, what is Jamal Adams asking for, right? What does he want ultimately? And to me, Jamal Adams is in a Quentin Dunbar situation. He either wants a new deal that is going to match his talent with the New York Jets, or he wants to be traded to a very good team. So if you talk about it from that standpoint, guys, I'm all in on Jamal Adams. I'm all in on the Seahawks, and we can talk about what that means for the team and all that. But if the Seahawks are interested in Jamal Adams and he's willing to play out, at least for this season, on his current deal, I think that that could be a really dynamic trade and a big boost for the Seahawks that could really make that defense and that defensive backfield back to that Legion of Boom, you know, type of status again. Because Jamal Adams, as much as we reminisce about Cam Chancellor, Jamal Adams is a generational talent at that position and plays very similarly to Cam.
Question, Jake, when you were speaking to this friend in the front office, did you get the impression he was saying, oh, the Seahawks are interested and they're one of the teams making a play for him? Or did you get the impression that, like, no, there might be some legs to this rumor?
Yeah, I think that it's a good question, because in the conversation that I had, it was more of the sense that they were in pursuit. So there have been other teams that have been around Jamal Adams and have been interested in him. But I think that contract or that trade conversations are heating up around Jamal Adams, and that the Seahawks in particular are a part of those teams are continuing to pursue Jamal Adams. So this isn't one of those things where they're going to sit back and wait and see how this goes. They're actively pursuing this situation, and it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. I don't know if they'll end up getting Jamal Adams, but they're definitely in the discussions for him.
What do they have to give up to get him?
That's another intriguing question in itself. And I think right off the top, you're looking at a first round pick, first and foremost. And then the second part is, it either comes down to a player or it comes down to a third round pick somewhere in that range for Jamal Adams. The Jets want premium. They want premium return for a player like Jamal Adams. But if you're the Seahawks, I mean, I'll ask you guys this. Would you care if the Seahawks gave up their first round pick next year for Jamal Adams?
Yes.
No.
You wouldn't, Tom?
No. I mean, that's like drafting a generational safety.
I guess the way I think about it is, I think they have so many steps to take on defense that in my mind, this isn't an easy fix. But I guess it is true. Like, if you're drafting a guy that's young, you still get a guy that's proven. So, Tom, you convinced me in like 30 seconds.
Right. But the problem is, if we're trading for him, is he going to want a new deal in 2 years? Like, does he want to be the highest paid safety in the game?
Well, he'll need a new deal.
He'll need a new deal. He'll absolutely need a new deal. And I bet you that he would probably, maybe the Seahawks could convince him to play on that $10 million contract for his fifth year option. But the reality is that Jamal Adams would probably want a new deal even before that. He would want an extension. And yeah, he would probably want big money, Tom. But when you look at Jamal Adams, he is a generational type of safety. He is a Cam Chancellor that can hit, but he's also a guy that can play sideline to sideline. And he has, in the past two seasons, guys, he's had 12 sacks. I mean, like, this is a guy who can play. He's dynamic. He brings something different to the table in a lot of different ways. And for me, I would absolutely give that first round pickup, especially guys. We're not talking about a top 15, a top 5 pick. We're talking about a continual bottom of the first round type of draft pick. And we all know how the Seahawks have operated. They've either traded that pick away anyways, right? Or they've gotten guys that have been questionable down the line, right? I mean, Jermaine Ifedi, Rashad Penny, Jordan Brooks, we'll see what he ends up doing for the organization. So to me, I think that you absolutely give that first round pick away. And if they want a third, I would give it away too. I think Jamal Adams is definitely that type of talent. And it tells me that you then have Quandre Diggs and Jamal Adams as your safeties for the foreseeable future. That's a pretty dynamic combination right there.
I'm looking at his stats here, Jake. You're right about the 12 sacks. 2, 3.5, and then 6.5 over 3 years. Look, and I'm not saying I judge safeties specifically by interceptions. I don't. They do a lot of other things other than that. But is it surprising that he only has 2 in his career?
It is surprising because he's a guy that is all over the field, Tom. I mean, he's a guy that is lined up everywhere. So it is a little surprising. But again, it's not necessarily his game to turn the ball over by interceptions. He's causing fumbles. He's laying huge hits. But he is a good cover safety. I will say that, Tom. Although the interceptions aren't there, he's a very good cover safety. And like I said before, around the league, Quandre Diggs is highly respected. He doesn't have the name as everybody else, but I think that Quandre Diggs will get that reputation over this next season. And you pair those two guys together, and Quentin Dunbar is hopefully able to continue to play, and his legal situation looks positive at the moment. We'll see. But you make those additions in that secondary, I mean, that's a big difference for you. You still got to get after the quarterback, guys, but that would be a nice boost to that team for sure. And I was surprised, guys, as I was talking to that friend of mine in the front office, who is, a part of a team that is going after Jamal Adams themselves, sitting there saying, yeah, the Seahawks are definitely in play here, and they're a contender.
General reaction from the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line that I'm glancing at right now. 710-710 if you want to join the conversation. Tends to side with both you and Tom in this one. From the 808, 808s and heartbreaks. First round picks next year could be worthless, as there might not even be a college season. Something to consider. Someone else, 425, said 100% worth trading our first round pick that we will already waste. Very disappointed with some past picks there. 425, a separate 425, also agreeing they usually trade that pick anyways, plus we'd know what we're getting.
I mean, the last two times they've done that, they traded it for Percy Harvin first, right, in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
When they traded Max Unger away for Graham, did they trade their first round pick there too, or was
included?
And then they received Graham and I think a fourth.
Okay. I mean, you could say that they've gotten mixed results in trading their first round picks, but I don't really think that those past moves have anything to do with what could happen with Jamal Adams. What are you whispering
Absolutely.
To me there, Ross?
Every time we talk about the Jimmy Graham trade, I have to contend that Jimmy Graham did nothing wrong. He was acquired via a trade and could have been used differently than he was used. And were he used differently, I think we all might be seeing the trade in a different light.
Well, I do agree with that, Stacey. Okay. But I also think that when you talk about Jamal Adams, this is a different conversation than Percy Harvin. Jamal Adams is not an injury guy, right? Jimmy Graham doesn't necessarily need to be used in a particular way. Jamal Adams would fit into the Seahawks defensive scheme, and I think also that it would allow them to be a little bit more creative with some of their blitz schemes and things of that nature, because Jamal Adams is very good in that area. So for all intensive purposes, I know we've talked about defensive end being a priority, and I still hope, guys, that they can land Clowney on a really one-year, small deal because the market has just completely vanished. But Jamal Adams is definitely worth that type of trade.
All right, let's get to three questions, shall we?
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
Does everybody out there remember the decision? LeBron appearing on TV with Jim Gray at a boys and girls... Was it a boys and girls club or a boys club? I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
In front of a bunch of young
kids. Boys and girls club.
Okay. Young kids from Akron who had to sit there and watch LeBron say he's leaving. Those poor kids. But in thinking about this 10 years later, this is the 10-year anniversary of it, that whole spectacle gets a lot of criticism. LeBron handled it wrong, ESPN handled it wrong, etc. Other than the kids sitting there having to watch their hero say he's leaving. What was handled so poorly about that? I've never really thought that that was... There was anything really, I don't know, that they did that was so terrible. What do you think, Jake?
Well, yeah, that's a great point. Outside of that, I think that it's just a really hard situation to have this big old spectacle around this thing. And really, it's the first time that it ever happened, right? The first and only time that a professional athlete has made such a spectacle around their decision to where they're going to play, right? And I think that in that regard, it made LeBron look selfish. It didn't cast the best light on him. It looked like he was an attention seeker. And also, what happened with that was, you look at what ended up happening. You talk about him and D. Wade and Chris Bosh there and LeBron saying 4 or 5, championships and all that. I think that it just was not handled in the best way for him in terms of showing what he's about. And I think it made him look a lot more egotistical and selfish than he is.
I mean, there was this article from The Undefeated that LeBron James talking about how he used the decision, the actual show, to raise more than $2 million for the Boys and Girls Club. I know Tom mentioned that, but it's hard to be like as judgmental with that. I don't know. I really like LeBron James, so I'm going to have one of those very biased fan answers where if someone I don't like does it, I think they're incredibly selfish. If LeBron or someone I like does it, I'm like, I mean, it's fine, whatever. It's LeBron. He can do what he wants. It's Beyonce. Who cares what she does?
I'm still not understanding what's selfish, though. I mean, everything these days is a spectacle. Now, I realize that was 2010, but even back then, I'm just not like that was such a highly anticipated event. Not the show, but where LeBron was going to choose to go. Like, for months, everybody speculated. Why not turn that into a TV special? I don't blame anybody for handling that the way they did. Next.
Number two.
What do players do with the jerseys they exchange? The reason why I'm asking this is because one of the COVID protocols in the NFL, and we'll go through them later, is that there's no jersey exchanges allowed after the game, which makes some sense to me. But what do those guys do with those jerseys, Stacey?
I mean, maybe they all take them. Well, you have to clean out your locker at the end of the season, so who knows if they bring those jerseys back. But during the course of the season, I always notice jerseys from jersey exchanges staying in the locker. So, like, especially the longtime veterans, they accumulate jerseys for pretty much every game and really, like, throughout the course of your career. So when you would pass, like, Bobby Wagner's locker, KJ Wright, Richard Sherman when he was here, they'd have, like, a whole, group of, like, what looked like, 10, 15 jerseys hanging up in their locker kind of off to the side. So I think that that's probably, I've only ever covered the Seahawks, but I have to think that's a version of the norm, that it's kind of this thing that you just kind of collect and you hang up in your own locker as the season goes on. But yeah, I think that's really where you see them, at least from a reporter's point of view, is they're just hanging in the player's locker next to the rest of his stuff because it's like a Boy Scout badge. Like, I'm collecting these throughout the year from people I admire.
A Bobcat badge.
Well, and the more like well-known you are, you get like really cool ones,
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of guys are lazy to just bring them home, so they end up sticking in the locker. But when they're forced to bring them back, what they all do is what they're for is, one, they're for memories, and two, they're to make your trophy room sweet.
Look really
that's
cool.
What they're there for. Yeah, I mean, that's really what you're going to put them in shadow, in a shadow box. You're going to hang it up, Tom. It's going to look nice. But here's the one thing, Tom and Stacey, that I think is just absolutely hilarious about the NFL canceling the jersey exchange and why I think it's more of a publicity PR move than an actual benefit to the players. So you're telling me that it's okay for those players to hit each other, make contact with each other, sweat on each other, be on top of one another at different points of the game, and yet exchanging a jersey is a bad thing that they don't want you to do? Like, how does that make sense to me?
Tom disagrees with me on this one because I'm with you and Richard Sherman. I saw that and I thought, this is kind of weird. Yeah, like, why are you having me for 4 hours play against guys and be in guys' faces? And then all of a sudden, suddenly it's like, oh, it's after the game. Suddenly, like, COVID is contagious now. But then Tom came in. This is his point.
Okay, well, then don't have a season then. Look, if we're going to play football, there's nothing like the hitting and the piling up and being close to each other on the field. That's necessary.
Yeah.
Jersey swapping is not necessary. So why increase your chances on top of the fact that you may get it from the playing, just from playing football? If you don't get it there, why increase your chances later on by swapping jerseys?
Well, I guess at that point, my argument would be is, aren't they already exposed? Aren't they already exposed to those players? And
yeah, but why? But those... why increase that, Jake? That's like saying you know what? No, hold on. That's like saying, you know what? I'm going to go down to a protest without a mask for 2 hours as opposed to one, because 2 hours isn't any worse than one. It is. You're giving.
Well,
you're
on.
Further exposing yourself.
Hold on, Tom. I don't think that's comparable, because when you go to a protest, is everybody at that protest getting tested regularly? Are they going to that facility and getting tested on the regular? And no, like, arguably those players that are playing should be COVID free, right? Or else they shouldn't be playing, and that they should be identifying that they're not playing, right?
The reason why they should be COVID-free, though, is because they're adhering to the protocol.
Well, I know,
and not swapping jerseys.
I know, but it's like a chicken and egg. Like, if they entered the game in the first place, every single player that enters the game, every single coach and personnel member on the sideline must have been tested before they start to play. The way I interpreted it was, part of Richard Sherman's critique is saying the NFL wants players to play no matter what. Is safety really their top priority? Or is this just something they're tacking on to make it look like, and we want to make sure that we keep our distance after the game as a way to make it look like.
Well, what other reason?
But then you could argue, Tom, some people could really argue that the longer you are, and this is true, that the longer you have exposure to an area or person that might be contaminated, the higher that risk goes. Like, that is true thus far that we know about COVID. It's the reason that they wanted to limit stays in salons or whatever to 30 minutes or less. But I think what Richard Sherman is critiquing is whether or not the league truly values safety, or whether they're doing that for scientific purposes.
Dude, Richard Sherman takes every opportunity he can to make the league look like a bunch of jerks who don't care about him. That's just his thing. Do you think that the league, do you think that the league cares about jersey swapping at
all? I don't trust a billionaire as far as I can throw them.
I know you don't, but you hate billionaires no matter what.
Yes.
So, why do you think that they're implementing this rule? Why would they care about this other than just trying to, dot all the I's and cross the T's and make sure that the game is as safe as it can be if we're going to have a season? If we want to play football, we got to have some parameters. This is one of them. If Sherman wants to bellyache about that, never mind. Now we're just going down that road again.
No, you have a good point. You have a really good point, Tom. I'm giving you a hard time.
You do have a good point, but I do think it is funny to look at that and to see that and to have that opinion of, look, I've been hitting these guys and now I can't exchange a jersey with them. Overall, I'm not going to complain too much, but I do think it is a little funny.
We don't have time for my third question, but we kind of talked about it already with forcing trades and Jamal Adams. We'll come back to it later anyway. It's a big topic on today's program. All right, guys. Was that debate heated enough where we need to ask Mike Sauk about it? I guess we do.
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll talk to him next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
All right, before we get Mike on the horn here, and we'll ask him about what we were just talking about with the NFL banning jersey swapping as part of COVID protocol, I just want to say the reason why. And by the way, Richard Sherman thinks that that's phony on the part of the league, because they're already, piling up on each other every 30 seconds on the field. Why should jersey swapping be, be outlawed? Are they really looking out for our safety? I see Richard Sherman as a person that applies his own narrow convictions to every single situation he encounters. Like, he already believes that the owners are evil, and so every time the owners do something, he goes after them, assuming that they're evil. It's just not true. If you're making COVID protocol and you're trying to keep the game as safe as it can be, maybe it can't be safe. Maybe they shouldn't play at all. But if they're trying to add parameters to make it just a little bit safer, it shouldn't be taken as a personal affront by Richard Sherman. Okay. Mike, you heard all that. What do you make of the league banning jersey swapping? You think that's bogus, or you think that that's a reasonable thing to do?
Well, I'm surprised, I guess, Tom. You're saying that they're doing it because of COVID-19. I thought they were banning jersey swapping because it was reminiscent of soccer. No, it's actually because of COVID-19.
Yeah, it's actually because of COVID.
Okay, good. Just checking on that. I mean, I'm all for banning jerseys because it's stupid, but I think I'll go with Richard on this one. I generally find Sherman to be exactly as you said, Tom, that he's kind of fitting everything into his narrative that he wants it to be in. But in this case, I think what he's doing is more – well, actually, I can't tell. I can't read his tweets because he blocked me, so I'm not entirely sure what Sherman said. But my guess is that it's about, you know, this. There's a hypocrisy here. If you're saying that the game is safe enough for us to roll around with each other on the floor – don't tell me on the ground. Don't tell me that I can't swap jerseys at the end. That, you know, there's a level of hypocrisy there that he's pointing out. And I think when you point out the hypocrisy of the NFL owners, I think he's probably not wrong. While I tend to agree with your larger point about Sherm, I think I get where he's coming from here.
Yeah. Salk, I got some interesting information from a friend of mine who works in a different front office in the NFL, and he was saying that the Seahawks are actually in pursuit of Jamal Adams, the Jets' safety. What would you make of that if the Seahawks were to pull the trigger and make that trade?
I mean, obviously, it's difficult to say without knowing what they would have to give up in order to do it. But I'm pretty firmly on the record in years of talking about it in saying that safety play is incredibly important to the success of a good defense. That great safeties knock your block off when you come across the middle. They affect the play of the other team's offense and especially their receivers. They shut down many of the great tight ends that the Seahawks will see on a week-to-week basis, especially in their division. And they cause turnovers. And what is Pete's mantra when it comes to defense and really offense too? It's all about the ball. Well, they haven't come up with nearly enough turnovers over the last few years. And if they strike out over and over again in their attempts to try to improve the pass rush, which apparently they've done, well, you got to find somewhere else to get better. And at this point, look, I like Bradley McDougal. He's been a nice player for them, but he's not a star. I certainly like what you got from Diggs last year, and maybe he is going to end up being that star. And I continue to clamor for Marquise Blair. I would assume that someone like him would be included in a deal like that. But if you have a chance to add someone like Adams who can legitimately change the game with turnovers, with hits, and if I'm not mistaken, didn't he get to the quarterback like five or six? How many times did he get to the quarterback last year?
Six and a half.
A lot, yeah.
That would have led the Seahawks by like double. I mean, like maybe that's how they're going to get their pass rush. Just bring in Jamal Adams and let him rush the passer because God knows no one else on the team can. So, yeah, I think that there would be some value to it. But again, how much do you have to give up? Are you talking two first round picks and Marquise Blair? At that point, I'd probably start to have some questions, especially not knowing how long he's going to be on my team.
What if it was just a first and Blair? I know you're really high on Marquise Blair, so I'm wondering if like, I go back to the Clowney trade, and I remember really liking Jacob Martin, but obviously that seemed like so obviously a one-sided deal. But Marquise Blair is someone who's really promising, and he was your second pick.
Yeah, I'd probably do that. I'd probably do a first-rounder and Marquise Blair, and especially if I knew that, you know, what kind of a deal it was going to take to keep him around long-term. That guy's a really good player. I mean, he's a top-notch, take-the-ball-away safety. So, yeah, I'd probably pull the trigger on that, and I probably wouldn't hesitate.
Mike, when you use the phrase knock somebody's block off, what body part does block refer to?
That's a good question, Tom. We're not allowed to talk about it. It's like Fight Club. It's a secret part. You don't want to know where the block is.
You know what? When the first time I ever heard that phrase, it was from Mickey in the Rocky movies when he kept screaming that at Rocky. And I always, even as a kid, I wondered, like, what does he mean by that? Like, block? What's he talking about? I don't know. Anyway.
I think when I think of it, I think of Chuck Cecil.
Chuck Cecil?
Remember that guy? Remember Chuck
Cecil? I know
Cecil
the name.
Got in trouble for spear. He's now like a defensive coordinator, I think, in the league or something like that. But he was the one who kept getting in trouble for spearing. He was a safety, and he used to just launch himself helmet first into people.
Okay,
like a
yeah.
whole bunch of penalties, and he was sort of Jack Tatum after Jack Tatum, and that's what makes Cam such a legendary Seahawk in my book. Is he did all of that and did it in a way that was legit? It was legal. He didn't need to use the crown of his helmet and spear through the air to cause the amount of damage that he did. And we can spend all the time we want talking about how the Seahawks defense changed after various guys left, but I would submit to you that losing Cam, and not just losing him once his career ended, but even some of the way it deteriorated at the very end, that when Cam was at his best, that was as important to the Seahawks defense as anything. Yes, of course it mattered to have 2, 3, 4 guys coming off the edge who could all get to the quarterback, and that's probably right up there in terms of importance. But I'll throw Cam out there as well because he was just so unique and provided such a devastating, approach to the game of hitting. And that changed the game over and over again. It caused turnovers, both with fumbles and with interceptions, and just his presence consistently altered what other teams did. I think Jamal Adams could have some of that same type of presence.
Salk, I'm not sure if this has been asked to you yet, but I don't know if you saw that the NFL asked players to or potentially have players' salaries be put in escrow. Did you see that report?
I did, and I'm not entirely sure what to make of all that. I can't imagine the players are going to go along with something like that. And then similarly, I don't know if you guys saw this one. I saw today Darren Rovell somewhere saying that NFL franchises are down like 20% or so in value, which I don't entirely believe. And because of that, he thinks that there may be a whole bunch of franchises that come up for sale. He even mentioned the Tom's Giants as one of those franchises that might come up for sale. It's an interesting idea. I don't know whether I'd buy either one of those things, and specifically the second. I mean, I can't imagine that NFL franchises are really going to lose all that much value just because of a temporary setback. And I also don't believe that as smart as those owners are with money, that any of them are going to say, oh, my franchise is down in value, now I'm going to sell. I think they'll wait for that franchise to come back up. So I would probably disagree with Darren, but as a long way of getting back to answer your question, I'm kind of on Sherm's side on this, Tom. Like I think any opportunity ownership has to try to stick it to the players and try to make sure that they're whole, they'll take. And I think this is the beginning of what may end up being a very messy negotiation in the NFL to coincide with another messy negotiation in baseball.
Well, yeah, I mean, the money is one thing, but swapping jerseys, come on. Look, I want to move on to something else.
Sure.
Jim Moore put something up on 710sports.com. Marco Gonzalez is a guy who's spoken out very openly about the cheating scandal in the Astros in particular. Do you think he's going to throw at anybody?
It's a good question. Marcos doesn't seem like, I mean, he's such a nice dude. I mean, never talked to Marco Gonzalez. He is as unassuming and normal as baseball players get. I mean, he really is. He's just a nice guy. On the other hand, he's the one who didn't mind spouting off about what both the Red Sox and the Astros, if I'm not mistaken, over the years and even right after games. So he's obviously taken this stuff pretty seriously. And on Twitter, anyway, he doesn't mind talking a little bit, and he doesn't mind saying it now and then in an interview. I don't know whether or not that translates to, I've got a weapon that I can throw 90 miles an hour in my hand. I don't know whether he's the guy to do that or not, but I'm sure curious to find out. I mean, again, we're going on over a decade here since the Mariners have had any kind of a bench clearing brawl or really anything close to it. So it would be interesting if, and somewhat surprising if Marco Gonzalez, of all people, was the one to start that. But sometimes that's who it is. Sometimes it's the guys you're not expecting to just lose their cool one day, have a reason for it, and the next thing you know, they're off to the, you know, off and running. I just hope for his sake that it doesn't turn into like a Paul Wilson, Kyle Farnsworth situation.
Oh my goodness. He took him down like a line. He drilled him like Chuck Cecil is what he did.
It's probably the best form tackle I've ever seen.
No doubt about it. All right. Thanks, Mike, for jumping on. We appreciate it.
See you guys.
All right, coming up next, we're going to hear from Jerry DePoto about how difficult this whole process has been, plus the progress of one Jared Kelnick who hit one off the Hit It Here Cafe the other day. I want to hear about that. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
A reminder for everybody, show's going to sound different tomorrow. Baseball returns. The Mariners will play their first inter-squad game to get ready for their season. And 710 ESPN Seattle is the only place to hear it. Rick Riz and Aaron Goldsmith have the action Friday at 2:30. So halfway through hour three of Tom, Jake, and Stacy, you'll be hearing Mariner baseball. How about that? Speaking of Mariner baseball, guys, I think the very last conversation, if I remember, that we had about the Mariners before a pandemic struck the U.S., was that Jared Kelnick, there was like a possibility, or there was at least a groundswell of opinion about Jared Kelnick maybe starting the year with the Mariners. Now, I don't know that that was a good idea thinking back on that, but Kelnick is with the team right now. He destroyed a ball the other day. He hit the Hit It Here Cafe. I mean, it's totally possible that this kid is ready to go. But it's just a safe idea to not rush him. Let's hear from Jerry DePoto. Cut number three, by the way, on with Danny and Gallant this morning on Kelnick's home run.
And we get to hear it a couple of times a day. You know, that just happened to be the most dramatic. It's, you know, he hit that ball off the Hit It Here Cafe and in a simulated game against LJ Newsom, and it was one of those where as soon as he hit it, you know, your jaw just dropped at the sound and obviously how far it went.
Daniel Vogelbach's done that before, and I'm not giving up on Vogie, but Jake, what do you make of Kelnick and his place in this organization right now? You think we're going to see a lot of him, a little of him? What's going to happen?
It's hard. It's hard, Tom, because here's the thing. His talent is undeniable. I think even the way that Jerry DePoto is talking about Kelnick, how he's just kind of laughing in the, you know, you could just feel how excited he is about Jared Kelnick, truly, in watching him. But at the same time, I think it's really important that you hold him back. I really do. I think it's important that you give him a little taste of what it's like to play at the big league level, but to not just throw him into the fire. I think that he's got an attitude that would probably be equipped to handle all of it. But at the same time, I think even if he struggled in, let's say, 10, 15 games, that's easier psychologically to handle rather than going through a full, you know, 60-game season even of struggling through a year. Now, if he comes in and rips it up like Kyle Lewis did at the end of the year, like Kyle did last year, I think that that is a tremendous confidence-building moment for him, and therefore you feel even better about him starting to play at the big league level in 2021.
All right, let's go to another cut here. Just on the process, the way COVID has interrupted everything, trying to get everything organized. Cut number one here from DePoto.
This has been an incredibly difficult process to undertake for a lot of people, ranging from the executive level at MLB, the PA, our players, and so many staff members. The way we are adapting to what is baseball in 2020 and projects to be. And none of us could be less excited, truly, because as we've said from the beginning, you know, everybody wants to play. We want to get out there. And it's been so fun over this last week watching the players run around. And I think we're starting to find a rhythm in what is a schedule that's very different to what we typically experience.
Before Stacy weighs in here, I just want to play cut number two, talking about the test numbers and the protocols. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, we are very fortunate, and we had a pretty clean onboarding, and our intake process did actually really couldn't have gone a whole lot better. I mean, we understood that there were going to be some positive tests, and there were. All of those people are asymptomatic, which is a real positive for us, and hopefully we can get them all back soon and resume full activity. But we've been so diligent about following the protocols and not just the protocols that MLB has developed, but the protocols that exist with the city of Seattle and King County and the state of Washington.
What do you make of that, Stacy? I mean, you know, we talked about protocols with the NFL before and jersey swapping, but does it seem like baseball at least has a good ideas going forward about how we're handling this, at least up here?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it. I think the trickiest part, and we had Mike Blowers on yesterday talking with us, and I think one thing he stressed is true and will continue to be true throughout the rest of the summer while baseball tries to keep its 60-game season going, and that's that everyone has to be on board. Everyone has to buy in. Obviously, this will be true for whatever protocols the NFL and NCAA take moving forward, but baseball's laid theirs out so far. And I think that it sounded to me like what Blowers was saying was everyone has to take this seriously. If you're a 23, 24-year-old player and you think like, I'm not really worried about it, I might go to this party or whatever, you could shut down your whole clubhouse if you get sick and come back. And so everyone has to be on board. It's not going to be fun. It's not fun just deciding to like stay at home all the time and quarantine yourself all the time. No one has been loving it the last couple months, but it's especially important, not just for all of us, but for the MLB to get off the ground. I mean, if they have an uncontrolled spread, it sounds like they might have to stop.
Guys, I'm like a dog with a bone on this topic. I'm sorry, but I just want to make sure we see it through. What would be the difference between going to a party and increasing your risk of contracting COVID and swapping jerseys?
The people that you're going to the party with aren't people that are forced to follow the same protocols as you. So hypothetically, in any league, the NBA, which are going to be kind of in this weird like incubated area, but in any of the leagues and presumably the NCAA, everyone will be tested regularly. Everyone will be forced to follow the same protocols, and everyone, the rules, I mean, it's not like Roger Goodell is going to follow every player home and be like, now turn on your webcam so I can make sure that you're home and not with friends. Perfect. Thank you. You're just going to have to follow the rules. You don't know that people at a party are doing that. You don't know that they've ever been tested or that they're getting tested regularly. You don't know. I think it's one of those things where we were, talking about having not a party, but having three friends over for dinner on 4th of July. And our three friends knew each other and we'd still be a very small group. But we were like, should we do it? Because I trust that my three friends are all being cautious, but they might trust that their friends are being cautious and I don't know their friends. And then vice versa, it keeps going. So after a while, it's like this warped game of telephone where you're just trusting the people that you're around are being really cautious. The other thing you have to consider is that there are a lot of people, particularly young people, who can have COVID and not know it. And so if you're young, you're probably hanging out around young people and you could contract the virus and then, you know, God forbid that like other players get it and get seriously affected. But then you also have to think like, bench coaches, skippers, guys that are in their 50s, 60s or older, like who are more at risk, that becomes suddenly an incredibly dangerous conversation or situation.
Jake, 30
seconds.
Yeah,
absolutely. Simply put, one group is actually getting tested on a regular basis and has to clear those tests to be able to be on the field in the first place, and the other group is not. So a significantly higher risk of exposure to COVID in that regard. In terms of MLB players playing, those guys are playing with the idea that they are COVID-free. So I think the risk is mitigated in that situation.
It's entirely possible that none of these protocols matter and this virus just lingers in the air. It is going to get anybody it wants. But I guess if we want to have a season, what can we do other than just go ahead and try and just deal with the consequences later? All right, Brady Henderson. I was talking on the phone last night with Brady Henderson about a whole bunch of things, but he brought up a really good point about the Antonio Brown situation, something that led me to believe that they're not going to sign him. I actually have a piece up on 710sports.com about that and a few other things. So we'll talk to Brady about that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.